Welcome back to the Mastering Your Fertility podcast. This show is all about reclaiming health, enhancing fertility, and preparing for pregnancy. I'm Kristen Cornett, a holistic nutritionist and functional wellness practitioner at Tiny Feet.
And I'm Dr. Haley Knight, a naturopathic doctor and certified nutritionist at Synergy Women's Healthcare in Portland, Oregon. Our goal with this show is to educate and empower couples with the knowledge they need to get pregnant, stay pregnant, and have the healthiest baby possible.
All right, welcome everyone. Thank you so much for joining us this week. We certainly hope that you're able to find everything that you're looking for here on the podcast, but if you need additional resources to help you on your fertility journey, you definitely have some options for how to learn more from us. If you're looking for personalized one-on-one guidance for your health or fertility struggles, you can learn more about working remotely with me, Kristen, by visiting my website at tinyfeet.co, or you can schedule a free 20-minute phone consult right now through the link in the episode description. If you're local to the Portland, Oregon area, you can learn more about seeing Dr. Haley in person at her clinic by visiting drhaley.com. We've also created an online course together called Fertile in 5 Masterclass, which walks you through everything you need to know to prepare for a healthy pregnancy. Visit bit.ly/fertileinfive to learn more about the course and get signed up. If you'd like to get a free preview of what you can expect in the Fertile in 5 course and learn all about the most important nutrients and supplements to include in your preconception and pregnancy routine, you can sign up for the free mini course called How to Choose the Best Prenatal Supplements, and the link to enroll is in this week's episode description. You're listening to episode 65, and we're excited to have back one of our favorite podcast guests of 2019, dietitian and author of Real Food for Pregnancy, Lily Nichols. Lily joined us on the podcast almost exactly a year ago in episode 15, and that interview was jam-packed with all kinds of actionable info on how to support your fertility and a healthy pregnancy with real food. Lily is an experienced researcher and spends countless hours reading through new studies and sharing her findings with her growing audience, which means that she has a very close-up perspective on everything that we do know about prenatal nutrition and also everything that we don't know yet. And that brings us to the focus of today's interview, which is understanding why there's so much conflicting dietary advice out there, why nutrition science is so messy, and how we can change the way we think about nutrition research and government guidelines so we can find out what really nourishes each of us on a personal level. At the end of the day, there's no one perfect diet that works for everyone, and it's important for us not to get so caught up in the guidelines that we forget to be in touch with what's actually supporting our health and making us feel our best. The takeaway of this episode is letting go of nutrition dogma, strict food rules, and obsessive macronutrient tracking, and instead focusing on nutrient density and overall quality of the foods we're eating. As more and more research comes out in both the prenatal and general nutrition spheres, it's important to stay curious, continue questioning, and always evaluating new evidence in context. And that's exactly what the three of us are going to try to do for you this week. So let's go ahead and formally reintroduce you to our guest and get started on the interview. Lily Nichols is a registered dietitian nutritionist, certified diabetes educator, researcher, and author with a passion for evidence-based prenatal nutrition. Drawing from the current scientific literature and the wisdom of traditional cultures, her work is known for being research-focused, thorough, and sensible. Her best-selling book, Real Food for Gestational Diabetes, and online course of the same name, presents a revolutionary, nutrient-dense, lower-carb approach for managing gestational diabetes. Her work has not only helped tens of thousands of women manage their gestational diabetes, mostly without the need for blood sugar lowering medication, but has also influenced nutrition policies internationally. Lily's clinical expertise and extensive background in prenatal nutrition have made her a highly sought after consultant and speaker in the field. Lily's second book, Real Food for Pregnancy, is an evidence-based look at the gap between conventional prenatal nutrition guidelines and what's optimal for mother and baby. With over 930 citations, this is the most comprehensive text on prenatal nutrition to date. Lily is also creator of the popular blog, lilynicholsrdn.com, which explores a variety of topics related to real food, mindful eating, and pregnancy nutrition. You can find show notes for this week's episode, along with links to Lily's book and blog through the link in the episode description. We hope you enjoy the interview. All right. Welcome back to Mastering Your Fertility, Lily Nichols. We are so excited to have you back today.
Happy to be back. Thank you for the re-invite.
Absolutely. I've been wanting to do this for a while, actually. It's you know, it's amazing how much time goes by when you're busy working on things. And speaking of being busy, you have been awfully busy. So congratulations on the arrival of your daughter in 2019.
Thank you.
And how are things going being back at it as a busy mom of now two young ones?
Yes. Well, it's all crazy. I think people sort of noticed from my social media and blog posting or lack thereof that I spent a lot of time during my pregnancy preparing for a supported postpartum nutritionally, you know, with help from other people and all the things that really help you get through that very challenging time with a little more ease. And that definitely paid off. So I feel surprisingly, I can't say I'm like well rested, but I feel surprisingly pretty good and had a pretty smooth pregnancy, birth, and recovery, thankfully. So we're just getting back in the swing of work again and getting back to doing interviews and some more writing and exercising that part of my brain again, which feels good.
Yeah. At the time of this recording, you just released like a 9,000 word blog post on introducing solids for young ones. And I read that article yesterday. I actually read the whole article yesterday.
Hey.
and it was fascinating. And it's kind of seems like it should be an entire book of its own. I think that's probably been suggested a couple of times from your audience.
And you know, there's a lot of things that could be an entire book on its own. My postpartum recovery post was also suggested this should just be its own book. And I'm like, you know what? It could be, sure. There's always more to say. And so I have a hard time turning something that doesn't feel like a completed work into a book, because there's always more to say. And also, I think we need high quality evidence-based information out there for free for people. Mm-hmm. Books are relatively low cost, but still that's another barrier to getting information out there. And I'd rather put it on my blog for free than turn everything into a book. But you know, maybe someday, I don't know, I'm pretty nervous about putting anything out about feeding kids, because you enter into the realm of giving parenting advice, which I really don't want to do. I have no interest. I'm always putting hashtag burn all the baby books out there. It's just so annoying when you're a parent and everybody's basically telling you that you're doing it wrong. So I don't know, if I ever write a book on it, I will probably just be encouraging people and telling them that they're not doing everything wrong. But we'll see if that book ever gets out there.
It's a one-page book. You're doing great, mama. The end.
/ listen to your own child. You know, that's the important piece, is that every baby's different. So if you read a book that says something different than what you're doing that's working, okay, great. Maybe that works for other people. This is what's working for me.
Exactly.
So what are people asking for most from you for a next big project? Because, you know, every time you release a big work like Real Food for Pregnancy, it's always everybody wants to know what you're going to do next.
Well, there have been a lot of requests, and I don't know which one will take the reins next. I started writing Real Food for Pregnancy when my firstborn, my son, was 10 months old, and it was, you know, an all-in project. I was basically not on social media at all, and every nap time was spent working on it, plus like my very limited childcare of like 9 to 12 hours a week. You know, it was an all-in, all of my limited free time was spent working on it. And now there's so many more things in the air. You know, I also run the Women's Health and Nutrition Academy, and there's so many things I want to be doing that I have a hard time narrowing it down. But there's been requests for feeding kids, feeding babies. Someone said, write Real Food for Life and just write to the general audience. People ask about writing for menopause, about fertility and preconception. People want a separate book on postpartum, which shocks me actually, because I put such a detailed chapter on postpartum in Real Food for Pregnancy, figuring like nobody has the time or bandwidth to read a book on postpartum when you're postpartum, and you're probably not going to read it beforehand, right?
Maybe I don't know. Maybe they will. Third,
maybe you will. I don't know. I wouldn't have. So maybe I'm biased. But there are, those are all possibilities and more. And I'm not sure. I'm not sure yet.
Well, I'm excited to see what comes next. I'm sure, you know, over the next few years, we'll hear about something coming out from you. And in the meantime, you know, your blog is updated all the time with new articles, and your Instagram is always teeming with new research briefs. And, you know, you're definitely keeping an eye on what's happening out there, which is very valuable.
Well, thank you.
So today is going to be an episode about controversy in a lot of different ways, and kind of understanding why there's so much controversy around nutrition guidelines, both overall, but also in the context of fertility, pregnancy, postpartum, you know, why we have all these different recommendations. People are confused. They don't know what to listen to. There's all this advice out there and they just want to be healthy and like do the right thing. So I guess the first question is, why is nutrition so hard to study? Why do we have all of these, why do we have all this conflicting information out there in the first place?
That's a good question. That probably is going to take a really long answer. I think nutrition is really tough to study because there are so many confounding variables. It's really hard to control for all of the variables within a diet and like, you know, all the way to the level of like the person's income and what they have access to and how it's prepared and what's the nutrient level in this versus that, what are their genetics? I mean, there's so many things that like you can't control for or are difficult to control for, that in the case where you do have controlled feeding studies where people are literally like locked up in a facility and they formulate their diets. I actually worked in a place like this during my dietetic internship. It was really interesting and also like really disgusting what they were feeding them. but you know, you have two diets and the one thing that you're changing is the type of protein that they're fed, but you need to keep everything else about the diet the same, down to like the same grams of carbohydrates and whatever. That already, that's like as controlled as you can get, and that already introduces weird variables because that's not real life. People are not eating ad lib the amount that they might if they were at home. So then you have the studies where they prepare the food and they provide the food and the people eat the food at home. But how do you know that they're not sneaking like a chocolate cookie at night afterwards? Like you can't control that. Mm-hmm. So those are just, you know, two examples, but then you have the epidemiology where we're looking back at what did people eat over this period of time and what are their probably looking at health outcomes. Those are also super messy because you're relying on people's recall of what they ate over that period of time, usually via something called a food frequency questionnaire or some other survey sort of a thing. And I don't know about you, but you know, unless I'm logging every little bite of food that I eat, I don't have that great of a memory on what I ate even, you know, 3 days ago. What did I have for breakfast again? Was it XYZ? So you're looking at, you know, information from these studies is really from questionnaires that are saying, how often do you eat eggs per week? You know, less than one or more, you know, they're not specific and they're just not accurate. And there's been plentiful studies out there looking at how messy the science is related to studying nutrition. And they find that a lot of people just lie about what they eat too. And I mean, both of you know, in clinical practice, I'm sure you see this. Once you get talking to a person, things start coming out that they maybe forgot to say or intentionally have withheld, maybe for fear of judgment or something else. It's just the science of nutrition is very, very messy.
Yeah, it definitely is. And I agree with that, seeing that in clinical practice where usually the first conversation with somebody is, oh yeah, like I eat pretty healthy and oh, I focus on these foods and I focus on these foods. And then you get a food journal back from somebody and you're like, okay, so maybe that doesn't exactly line up with what you told me in the first place. But then you get like the qualifiers. Well, like, oh, this was happening during this time. And so this isn't really representative of what I actually eat on a regular basis. It's like, okay, but how often are these confounding factors happening? Because it's life, right? And how many of us are always in what we would consider like a perfect routine? So that's a really good point. And I think that there have been some analyses done of these food frequency questionnaires. And some of them have discovered that if they were actually true, if what some of these people said they were eating was actually accurate, they weren't actually eating enough calories to like sustain life.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, you know, then that begs the question of where is all the other stuff coming from then in the diet?
People generally tend to underestimate the amount of food they eat, I've observed anyways. So yeah, they're often quite off.
So I know that they have studied then, because they've probably recognized these, this is not working well with nutrition research. And so they studied Seventh-day Adventist members as well as a cohort. Do you know anything about kind of like the results of those nutrition studies and if that's accurate or not, or what are your thoughts on that?
I mean, the Seventh-day Adventists tend to be vegetarian, though not all members of the church are strict vegetarian. And so there's a like maybe sliding scale of how strictly plant-based they are or not. Some are full vegan, some include some animal products here and there. I've looked at a few of those studies in relation to some of the research I included on soy in Real Food for Pregnancy, but I can't say I've looked at Seventh-day Adventist studies super recently. So was there a specific area that you were curious about?
I just know that they've been included, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you know, the blue zones, there's like seven zones or seven groups of people or something like that, where they live longer than the general, you know, white Europeans or whatever. And I believe the Seventh-day Adventist is one of those groups. Mm-hmm. However, there's a lot of other groups that eat differently as well. And so I think part of the blue zones too is including lifestyle factors, sleeping, right, less stress, you know, a lot of other variables involved. And so again, just like we were talking about how there's confounding factors where you can't necessarily just look at one's diet and say, oh, well then it's this is the answer.
Right.
Especially because it's so strange how there's a lot of, I don't know if they're substantial studies, but there's studies that are supporting this kind of keto way, diet, you know, low carb on losing weight. And then there's a lot of studies on vegan type of diets, and there seem to be really vastly different in as far as like how you're eating on a day-to-day basis. However, they're both showing, benefits. And I've actually heard some cardiologists say, well, pick one or the other. They both seem to be having an effect. So it's just really fascinating how that's how messy our nutrition studies are. It's like, well, they're both kind of showing benefit. So,
right. And yeah. I think ultimately when you get down to some of these things, it's a matter of the people that are included, the people that are doing these studies have received some sort of nutrition education or guidance, and as such are typically eating significantly less sugar and refined carbohydrates and processed food than they would be otherwise. And that alone, regardless of like, you know, arguing about macros or how much animal foods you're eating or whatnot, that alone is linked to huge health benefits. Just displacing the empty calories with real food, wherever it's coming from, is linked to benefits. And furthermore, when you're looking at some of these blue zone studies or information on the Seventh-day Adventists, you know, there's also that community factor that's built into it. So yeah, we know food is part of our wellness, and yes, deficiencies, overt deficiencies, especially in things, impacts our health, but also, you know, our mental health is important. And having, you know, like-minded people around us where we feel supported and loved, I mean, that's been shown on a physiological level to change the way that your body functions and improve your hormone balance and all the things. You guys see it in practice. Mm-hmm. So that's another one where, again, you introduce a confounding variable aside from food when you're studying a specific population group, even if they generally have a way of eating that almost everybody complies with.
I would argue that that's a bigger factor than most people would be willing to admit initially. I mean, I think working in fertility, you see so much of the mind-body connection and how mental and emotional well-being affects this entire process, even down to the odds of success during fertility treatment. And when you take such a big thing, like having a sense of purpose, having a deep sense of spirituality, being certain about your worldview and how you fit into a community and social security, those are huge, huge impacts on physical well-being. And I completely agree that you can't just isolate their diet in a study like that and say that that's the reason that they live longer. And even if you could, I mean, well, you couldn't, because healthy user bias is a thing too. I mean, people mm-hmm. who in these groups who are not eating a ton of animal foods or have varying amounts of animal foods that they're consuming are also typically not smoking, are generally taking better care of their bodies, and are engaging in other lifestyle factors that are supportive for health. And so I think the theme across this whole discussion is that what we try to do when we have nutrition studies is rather than use them to support a hypothesis and discuss it in a way that says, this is the information we have, here's what we still don't know, and we can't draw causal relationships from a lot of the studies that we have, we're kind of presenting this as this like dogmatic science that proves that XYZ food is unhealthy for you and nobody should include it in their diet. And none of this, we haven't even touched on like the bio-individuality piece. Like, everyone's different. Is there one single dietary approach that works for everybody? No, I don't think there is. What are your thoughts on that?
I agree with you completely. And I think this is the challenge of relying 100% on white paper data, is that everybody is different. And so, you know, just if we're talking about down to genetics, we were talking before we started recording about how some people have certain genetic variations that might make them have higher needs for choline or higher needs for vitamin A and require it in a different form so your body can utilize it. We all know about MTHFR and the folate issue. So these are things that are difficult to tease out. And I don't think we will ever have white paper data that's saying, yes, this always works. And I think that's why functional medicine is, you know, seeing such a boom to the industry, is that you finally have somebody who's looking at you as an individual and figuring out what might work best for you. So yeah, I don't know if we're ever going to have, you know, quote, the science settled on nutrition.
I would say I'm pretty confident about, and I hope you guys are too, about the science behind fruits and vegetables. And I think that's like, you know, if we had a Venn diagram, that's definitely like the middle where they're, you know, they overlap, and it's like fruits and vegetables absolutely cannot be argued about, and that they should really be the cornerstone of anybody's diet. And in practice, it's so interesting how people need to either kind of do an all or nothing, like whole foods, plant-based, like all, or I'm going to go all vegetarian or vegan that way. I know it's whole foods, plant-based more than vegan, but, or they're going to do keto, which is like somehow very low in ideal fruits and vegetables and like squashes and sweet potatoes and things like that. So, it's just trying to get this idea around like moderation and like focusing your plate with fruits and vegetables and not being scared of fruit really and know that they're high in micronutrients. And I just don't think that we can argue about that. So
agree.
Well, my social media feed would actually call question to that, because I have a lot of people who follow me who eat a very low carb, either ketogenic or some people full carnivore diet. And you can do keto with lots of vegetables on it, probably not a lot of fruit, depending on your carb limit. But there are a fair number of people who quite vocally question whether we need produce at all. And I think, so, you know, I have my own thoughts on the issue, but I think ultimately that again is a place where there's going to be some degree of individuality, because you have some people with like oddball health conditions and autoimmune things who happen to feel really good eating mostly carnivore, for example. Of course, for me, I'm always looking at the micronutrients. And so when I do a nutrient analysis, the way that people do full carnivore is not how the Maasai or the Inuit would do it. Right.
The traditional cultures that they're using to kind of justify this approach as like, well, these cultures are clearly able to be healthy on a mostly animal food diet. Right.
They don't eat like 3 pounds of steak twice a day as their meal. You know, I mean, you're eating nose to tail. And moreover, as somebody who's actually lived in Alaska and studied a lot about there's many different groups of traditional cultures, indigenous people up there who eat very differently depending on where exactly they are, because there's so many different microclimates up there, that food availability is very different. And you actually do include a fair amount of plant foods when they're available, and they go to great lengths to gather things like berries, for example, and preserve them in usually seal oil to consume at a later time when those foods aren't available. So even these cultures that are like very animal food heavy still are going to be, you know, we're opportunists as humans, we're omnivores, we're going to eat what's available. So yeah, I have my thoughts on the people who eat, you know, absolutely none. I think there's definitely a place. I think you can argue the quantity that works for one person over the other. But as a whole, if you're looking at like white paper nutrition data, yes, as a whole, that's the one area where almost everybody agrees fruits and vegetables are good for you. That's one where there's very little
controversy. But it's the one thing that I feel like most people aren't necessarily focusing on. Like, it's not...
they're focusing on whether or not they include animal foods or not. It's like, well, why don't we just talk about how many actual
or dairy,
like,
or
fresh or frozen fruits and vegetables that you're including? And it's like, you know... It's that's the problem with focusing so much more on what you eliminate from the diet than what you add to it.
Yes, I agree with that.
Yeah. So this is an interesting discussion, and I could go on about this topic of bioindividuality for like 2 hours, because I think, Lily, you're right. There are some people that have health conditions where they need something that's very different from the rest of the typical population. And I think there certainly is a place for maybe like short-term therapeutic diets that serve a purpose for symptom reduction for the person. But I also feel like it's not necessarily our design as humans to like only eat meat, or even necessarily to only eat plants. And we can exist in such a wide range of climates around the world where different foods grow in different places. And so that, to me, just thinking about where we've come from, you know, taking out of the picture the fact that we have the ability to transport food halfway around the world and eat things that don't exist in our local climates, you know, if you take that out of the picture and you look at it from like a, okay, if we didn't have all these modern conveniences, what would we live on? And could people in northern climates survive on a vegan diet when there weren't tons of plant foods available? No, they couldn't. So that's, to me, is one argument for bioindividuality and like understanding what would be available and how limited we would be in terms of where we could live if we all subscribe to the same dietary approach. It wouldn't make sense.
Exactly. There's actually a study, I believe it's a 2011 study. I cite it in, I think it's chapter 2 of Real Food for Pregnancy, where it's a a study on the diets of modern living, so currently living hunter-gatherer communities across the globe. And I think there were over 200 communities they studied, and they found a very wide range of macronutrient ratio, which usually is fairly reflective of the amount of animal versus plant foods as well, right? You have more fat and protein and less carbohydrates, you're probably subsisting on more animal foods versus the latter. And a lot of that had to do with the latitude at which the people live. And it's very, very new that we have this globalized food system. I mean, I didn't even think about it until recently. I grew up in Southern California, and I hadn't thought about this, but before we started importing avocados, and California sort of had the biggest stake in the avocado industry, that was a food that was only available seasonally. And so that, you know, as a kid, I only had avocados during avocado season, and didn't think about that until recently. Like, yeah, you can buy avocados at the store year round. That's so bizarre, including in Alaska, for example. They'll cost an arm and a leg, but yes, of course, they ship them up there as well, along with like a lot of produce that's going bad because it's been shipped from halfway across the world and sent on a barge or something. But it's very odd that we have such a wide availability of foods. I mean, and this can even affect people who are, you know, supposedly eating clean or eating a paleo diet. Like, how normal is it for you to be eating coconut oil when you live in Minnesota? You know, what the type of fat that you were probably consuming if you lived in Minnesota before that area was even called Minnesota was the fat that you rendered from the animal foods that you hunted, you know? So there's a lot of things like that I think are really odd about the way we eat nowadays.
Well, it's the craze around it too. And the thing is people just want to know, like, they just want to know what they, you know, the driving force behind it all is that they just want to be healthy. They want to live a long life. They want to have clear skin. They want to lose weight, you know,
they want to be fertile. Pregnant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So my heart goes out to everybody who's just like, can you please just tell me what the right thing is to do, you know? And we had this whole fat scare in the 90s where nobody ate lard anymore, even though for thousands of years, that was how we ended up, you know, that's what the fat that we ended up eating.
No, we ate Crisco. I mean, I was a kid in the 90s and, you know, we had a big tub of Crisco in the pantry and that was what we used to make like all of our pie crust. We didn't really bake a whole lot in my house, but like the one thing that we did, like every Thanksgiving and Christmas, it was my mom's like responsibility with the big family gathering with all 15 of us or whatever. It was her thing to make the pies. And we always like, you know, lug the big tub of Crisco out of the pantry and use that to make our pies. And now that just makes me ill to think about how much Crisco I probably ate. And then of course you'd cut off, you know, the little trimmings around the pie dish, the extra. And then we would either just like eat that raw, which is disgusting to me now, or we would like make it into cinnamon sticks and put a bunch of sugar on it so we could have some sugar with our margarine. Yeah. But it is interesting to think of things from a different perspective in terms of if we take modern life out of the equation, what do dietary patterns really look like? And what could we or could we not survive on as humans? We're very versatile and we can subsist on a wide variety of different things. But, you know, there are consistencies across cultures where we wouldn't have been eating processed foods. We wouldn't have been eating sugar. Most places, anywhere, you know, north of the equator is going to have some seasonality around the availability of fruit. And, you know, I think there are some things that we can glean. I think that's really what Real Food for Pregnancy does, is talks about real food and mindful eating too, to some degree, like being able to get back in touch with your body and really feel like, what is your body craving? What do you need specifically today to feel good?
For sure. Yeah. And on the fruit comment, I just want to talk about that a little more because we
go for it.
Well, we live in it's very odd that we can get apples and pears, for example, all year long. Those have a very specific season. Peaches, plums, cherries, even berries. We're able to get these foods year round because we're shipping them in from other countries that are more equatorial and have a wider season of being able to grow these foods. But it's very unusual that we even can do that. You know, usually apple season would be maybe a couple months. And for anybody who's had fruit trees, I grew up with fruit trees in my yard. So it was like, oh, the XYZ fruit is ready right now. We have to like the plum tree, right? They're all falling off at the same time. We have to like process and use them. And so you like either eat a ton of plums for a short period of time and then don't have them for a long time, which we totally did. Or you also find ways to process and preserve them. So you eat them in smaller quantities spread over the rest of the year. But it's very odd that we can buy apples year round. That's not normal. And yep. These people are like an apple a day, like what? No, you might have an apple a day or like five apples a day when it's apple season. And then you'd probably have a break from eating that food for a period of time. Even eggs, love eggs, big fan of eggs. If you have chickens, and I grew up with chickens, you know, they stop laying eggs usually for a period of time over the winter when it's either too cold or too dark. They're very affected. It's like a, you know, an egg is like a daily menstrual cycle. People get really like grossed out about that, but that's what it is. And when the light and temperature changes, they lay fewer eggs or they stop laying eggs for a while. So it's probably even unusual that we consume eggs every single day year round. All this stuff, I just think there's so much that lends itself to A, being less controlling about your food and like, this is the way to eat and this is the perfect XYZ. Mm-hmm. But also sort of taking into consideration, not just for, you know, nutritional purposes, but for the environment, like how are your food choices and always wanting to have this one particular food affecting the industry and the people around you and the growers in other countries and the fossil fuels used to ship your produce 3,000 miles and all that.
Well, that's its own very fascinating argument about plant-based diets in particular, is the argument for eating that way. One of the main ones that's used is the environmental impact of beef production primarily. But it's like, okay, what's the environmental impact of everybody in the world, regardless of where they live, eating plant-based when it's not available to get locally a large portion of the year?
Yep.
That's, again, its own podcast episode. Okay, so let's kind of switch gears back to the direction that we were going and kind of discuss this research thing in the context of preconception and prenatal nutrition. Prenatal nutrition is obviously your area of expertise. So what can we say about the guidelines around preconception and prenatal nutrition from an evidence perspective? Like, is what we're being told actually reflective of the best available research that we have out there? And most people who are listening to this interview probably already know your answer to that question because you wrote a book about it.
So there's a study out there that looks at how long it takes for current clinical research to make it into practice. And the average is 17 years. And it takes even longer to make updates to guidelines because typically people have to be practicing a certain way to push for a change in the guidelines. So of course they're outdated. The guidelines are always outdated because they're outdated by the time that they're released. The challenge is when you start picking apart at the guidelines, you can see just how many holes are in them. We spent the whole first part of this interview talking about how messy the science is on nutrition. And the original guidelines were set without science to back them up. Really, there really was not solid science to back them up. But now in order to try to change those guidelines, it's like people are demanding hardcore evidence in order to do so, which is, you know, good. We should have good evidence in order to change what the guidelines are. However, we're always up against this wall of there's not enough evidence to say XYZ is better than ABC because all of these confounding variables, clinical trials on this don't exist yet, that trial was of low quality. You know, there's always all these arguments against change. So I'm a bit radical in even suggesting that we can do better than the guidelines, because I also acknowledge that there's not perfect science out there. And ultimately what I'm pushing for is like a leading with the micronutrients first and then seeing where the rest of the diet falls into place. There's, you know, the pregnancy thing is one part of it. You brought up how, I just wrote this post on starting solids with baby, and I actually have another post in the works, assuming I can find all the time to continue researching and writing it, about the guidelines on infant sodium recommendations. Mm-hmm. And that, because everybody tells you you can't add salt to baby food, which if you're following a baby-led weaning approach is really challenging, because then you pretty much have to cook separate food with no salt, or get the whole house eating unsalted food, which I'm personally unwilling to do because I'm a big fan of making my food taste good. So trying to dive into like, where did these recommendations come from? Are they evidence-based? What science were they basing it on? Why did they come into play in the first place? What is the harm of high sodium for infants? Is it in fact, like, nobody, none of the baby-led weaning experts, none of the pediatric dietitians, nobody can answer the question as to why and give me a study on it. So I've been like spending, you know, dozens of hours looking at this issue, and it will all be written up in a post. But ultimately, this is like yet another very tiny and specific example of how we sort of accept that, well, this is the guideline, this is the way that everybody does it, this is the doctrine, and there's no room for questioning it. And then, like, why does nobody go back and look at, well, where did this actually come from? Because I feel, I don't know why this is like on my shoulders. I'm like supposed to be focusing on prenatal nutrition. I think somebody else should be doing this job. And, you know, that's why Real Food for Gestational Diabetes, my first book, was ever written, was because the guidelines didn't make sense in the context of what I was seeing in clinical practice. And I found there was very little evidence for the high carbohydrate recommendations that were failing my clients with gestational diabetes. So guidelines are like extremely frustrating to me, because when you really start looking at it, you find that there are holes beyond hole. It's like a black hole of lack of evidence behind what we're told to do. But, mm-hmm. You know, most clinicians do not have the time or wherewithal or interest to sit down and really research this stuff. It's a privilege that I'm able to do that. And that's why I want to, you know, keep sharing with people. But it is frustrating when you're like, oh gosh, was everything I taught wrong? I mean, not everything in the guidelines is wrong, but there's a significant portion that leaves, you know, a lot of room for improvement. And I find that really frustrating and disheartening.
Agreed, for sure. What would you say are the top areas, like if you had to pick maybe, let's say, three for preconception or prenatal nutrition, which of those guidelines are steering women and couples the most wrong, I guess?
Okay, so this one's tricky. Because as a whole, like the dietary guidelines that Americans are given, that ultimately informs what is given in pregnancy. And there's no separate guidelines for preconception, by the way. So right. The assumption is that preconception or fertility nutrition is just like
regular nutrition.
Yeah, regular nutrition. So, you know, a couple areas that are problematic. The carbohydrate level is recommended that we eat 45 to 65% of our calories from carbohydrates. And by default, that ends up limiting your intake of more nutrient-dense foods that have the micronutrients that you require to have, you know, better hormone balance, to ovulate regularly, to improve your egg quality, to improve sperm quality. I mean, really, a lot of the nutrients we're looking at for those things, like, you know, zinc, selenium, iodine, vitamin B12, choline, vitamin A in the usable preformed form. Those things are found in animal foods, which provide fat and protein, not carbohydrates. So that one is odd to me. And that I think has significant room for improvement. And of all dietary types that we have the most clinical trials on, it's low carb by far. So Dr. Sarah Halberg has like a great presentation on this, going through the studies on low carbohydrate interventions. And it doesn't necessarily have to be like we talked about, full on keto, full on carnivore, anything like that. Mm-hmm. It's just like, we do not need to be eating a grain-based, starch-based diet. And the vast majority of people are eating way too much white flour and white sugar. I've seen estimates that 85% of the carbohydrate intake in Americans' diets are from refined flour and white sugar. So that is an obvious area where if we're not pushing carbohydrates as much, then people won't feel like they're, well, it's okay because I need to eat, you know, my macros in this range. I think another area for improvement is dropping the fear around saturated fat and cholesterol, which in the guidelines ends up translating to limit your consumption of red meat and full fat dairy products. And again, it comes down to the micronutrient issue. If we're limiting those foods, those generally animal foods are the ones that have the most saturated fat and cholesterol, you are automatically limiting your intake of choline and vitamin B12 and iron and zinc, and all of these nutrients that are vital for fertility. Moreover, I think you too, and myself and many other dietitians and nutritionists and NDs and whatnot in clinical practice working with fertility and pregnancy health, those tend to be the clients, the ones who are really limiting their intake of animal foods tend to be the ones who have the most micronutrient deficiencies. And I have personally seen a lot of this. Mm-hmm. I don't know about you too.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Very, very much true.
Yeah. Usually low iron, low vitamin D, and low B12. That's kind of the three that come back pretty low.
And those you can find on just a basic blood panel for the most part. You can find evidence of that. You don't even need to necessarily do a whole micronutrient panel to get that information. But if you're seeing deficiencies in those, you can expect that you'll be seeing some deficiencies in others as well.
Right, right. So what, I covered two?
Those are big ones though.
Two big ones. I don't know. I'm sure
you got
there's
a third
more.
For us?
Third.
Protein. How about protein?
Protein. Well, so both in pregnancy and outside of pregnancy, there are ample research studies questioning whether the protein requirements are adequate. So in pregnancy, for example, the first ever study we had that directly measured protein requirements in pregnancy was done in 2015. That was only 5 years ago. Before then, our recommendations were entirely based on data from non-pregnant people. I think they included one study on pregnancy, but the way that we can study protein has changed significantly in the past two decades. So what's in the guidelines is out of date. They found that protein requirements are actually much higher in pregnancy than previously thought, especially in late pregnancy. They're 73% higher in late pregnancy than the estimated average requirement that's currently listed in the guidelines. And you see similar information like that when you look at protein requirement studies in non-pregnant people as well. So usually the recommendation is like 0.8 to maybe 1 gram of protein per kilo of body weight. And it looks like more like 1.2 grams per kilo would be the minimum that you'd want to go with if you're not pregnant.
Which doesn't sound like a lot, but when you multiply it out by kilograms of body weight, yeah, it's
it can be significant. It might be the difference between eating, you know, an extra 3 or 4 ounces of meat or eggs, or like a solid protein food per day, which for a lot of people is significant. And if you were to do a micronutrient analysis, you would probably see a big jump on a lot of their micronutrients, depending on what type of protein-rich food you chose.
Yeah, I think that's so important to be considering the micronutrients instead of just looking at being so, I think, obsessed and caught up in the macro thing. It's like, oh, I must eat, you know, 20%, yeah, at least 20% protein. It's like, okay, well, how does that translate into like actual food?
Actual food. And then
what does your micronutrient balance look like at that point? Like, are you just adding things or constructing a diet just to hit your macros? Or are you actually concerned with the quality and nutrient density of the foods that you're eating?
Yep. I see a lot of people get into really, really weird eating behaviors when they're super focused on macros. It's like macros should be a reflection of the diet quality, but you shouldn't be like macro first without considering what is actually providing you with nutrition. Yeah. It's like when the people go, you know, more on the keto side of things, and they're like, oh, I need to hit a certain fat percentage. And so then they're just like downing a bunch of fat bombs, which is like, well, I mean, okay.
Do you need to do that?
Right. Yeah. Are you sure that's the right thing to do? Or how much can you trust the calculators that told you what your calorie and then thus your macro requirements are? And can you even trust the nutrition labels? Because I don't know if you know, but FDA law, they're allowed to be 20% off in either direction. That's still legal. And I really wonder how many of these companies are sending off, you know, a full, let's say like a microwave dinner or something. How many of them are like packaging a microwave dinner and then like sending that off to an independent laboratory to use a bomb calorimeter and to estimate, you know, is it actually the amount of calories, fat, protein, carbohydrates that they say it is? Probably none. They're probably doing it on a calculation based on the raw ingredients. Who did they contract for that? How good are they at these calculations? I don't know. It's a big black hole, which is why I tend not to focus too much on numbers, because they're already inaccurate.
What would you tell our listeners? Like, what would be a good way to go about it?
So I think we need to focus on micronutrients first and where you find those in unprocessed real food. If your diet is primarily made of unprocessed foods that we know are probably meeting your micronutrient needs, even though they might not be perfect, right? How was the food grown? Was it in season? Like, the micronutrient breakdown is going to be different for a carrot that you got locally in season versus one that was shipped in from California, stored for who knows how long when you're living in Alaska, right? However, if you're leading with those unprocessed nutrient dense foods, the chance that you're going to overtly be eating a diet that is unhealthy, high in sugars and refined carbohydrates, nutrient depleted, excessive in energy, it's very slim. You're probably going to be doing a pretty good job. And you can also, if you're eating, choosing your portions from like a mindful perspective of like, eh, I'll serve this amount of food and then I'll see if this is enough. And if I want more, I can have more. Or maybe I'll eat most of my plate and decide, you know what, I'm not hungry for those last five bites. I'll put that away for part of my lunch tomorrow. Like, if you're eating from a place of mindfulness, the research on mindful eating is very interesting in that most people end up with, you know, maintaining a healthier body weight and also choosing to eat less junk food when they have started using mindful eating practices in real life. So some of these things are, it's like, control the type of food and the quality of food, but don't be so controlling around the quantity from a numerical perspective, and just sort of have a little trust that things will fall into place. I think I've been playing devil's advocate more than anything during this interview. So just, you know, raising questions about things versus giving like prescriptive answers. But I think there's this very sweet spot with real food and mindful eating. It just, things tend to fall in place when you incorporate both of those.
Yeah. That's a great answer. I really like that. I know that we were just talking about protein in pregnancy. And so you recently did a research brief on a paleo diet during pregnancy. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes, actually. And let me pull that up because I wrote a blog post on the paleo diet in pregnancy that expands upon the research brief that I had on my Instagram. So this was a, so speaking of the types of studies, this was one of the studies where they looked at people who were naturally eating a certain way versus another group who were naturally eating a certain way. So they had one group that was following a paleo diet, and they had followed that preconception and then were choosing to follow that during pregnancy. This is one of the things you see a lot in pregnancy research, is that they don't want to assign people to like a clinical study group because of all of the ethical concerns. Like, what if a paleo diet is unsafe? You know? So this was just an observational study, seeing what happened with the group that was eating paleo. And then the other half of the study participants were eating what they called a regular diet. And they didn't really go on to define what a regular diet is, but I would assume it's something like a standard American diet, because this study was conducted in the US. And all the people were generally, you know, low risk pregnant women. So they were excluded from the study if they had any pre-existing health conditions. Ultimately, what they found was that the results on the glucose challenge test, which is the 50 gram glucola that people drink as a screening method for gestational diabetes, they found that the people eating the paleo diet had significantly lower scores on that test. They found that there was significantly less anemia in the paleo group. They had both higher hemoglobin and ferritin levels. And they also found that weight gain, prenatal weight gain, so among the women, was lower on average in the paleo group. And also birth weight was slightly lower in that group as well, but it wasn't necessarily statistically significant. So overall, it was very positive. This is one of those studies that is probably leans very heavy on that healthy user bias, right? Mm-hmm. Because people who are eating a paleo diet are usually, they're doing it by choice. They have done some level of additional reading on it, which says that they have an interest in nutrition. Mm-hmm. They're probably going to be eating a lot less refined sugar. They're definitely eating a lot less refined carbohydrates, because your carbohydrate sources on a paleo diet are limited to essentially fruits and vegetables, nuts and seeds. And yeah, you can have like starchy vegetables on it, but you're automatically excluding grains, legumes, and dairy products. By excluding grains alone, you're going to be significantly limiting your sources of carbohydrates in the diet, because you're not going to be snacking on white flour crackers or eating pasta for dinner or having bread and sandwiches and such. But I think this is, you know, useful for us to see that there might be benefits to this way of eating, even with like the many possible limitations on this study. I detail more of the limitations in my blog post on the topic, and it is nice to see at least this way of eating represented in the research, because it is really, there's not a lot of studies on a paleo diet. Like I said, this was the first one in pregnancy. We have some in adults. We have some interventional trials with type 2 diabetes, for example, and they generally show benefit on weight, cardiovascular markers, blood pressure, and blood sugar or glucose control.
Yeah, it's nice to see this research, although it was a small study and it had, you know, some limitations to what we can glean from it. I think it's an opportunity to research this a little bit more and calls into question the idea that, oh, if you eat less than 175 grams of carbohydrate a day in pregnancy, you're being unsafe and you're putting your baby at risk. Mm-hmm. No, mm-hmm. No. You're not, especially if you're focusing on foods that are nutrient dense.
Mm-hmm. And it's definitely a nod with the higher hemoglobin and ferritin levels. That's definitely a nod to the importance of heme iron, which you get mm-hmm. from animal sourced foods. I know for myself, like my care team was surprised both pregnancies with how good my iron markers were. and I was not taking an iron supplement, and I specifically choose a prenatal vitamin that does not include additional iron. That's 100% food. Of course, there's a lot of things that go into iron status, like, you know, gut health and not having pathogens and all these other things that affect it. But it does give another nod to, yeah, food can make a difference, and you can actually get through a pregnancy with adequate iron just by food sources.
I see a lot of people in my practice who are supplementing have really interestingly dysregulated iron panels when I look at them.
Interesting.
So, you know, and you can over supplement iron. And if your body isn't actually, like, you know, your liver has a lot to do with what iron is doing in the body. It's a surprisingly complicated process, iron intake and, you know, packaging that up and whether you're making ferritin out of it. And there's different markers to look at on an iron panel too. There's a lot of steps in that whole process that can get dysregulated. And if you're consuming a whole bunch of iron that you don't need from supplements, you can see some interesting things on those labs. So
yeah, iron labs is like, they're so complicated. You start digging into the research on iron labs and it's like, holy cow, there's still controversy on this. You would think they would have that figured out by now, right? No.
Yeah, just for the general population, like not even from a prenatal nutrition perspective. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's still common to see high levels of iron. And there are some quality prenatal vitamins that just happen to contain a lot of iron. There's one in particular that I can think of that's commonly recommended. And, you know, this particular supplement has like 45 milligrams of iron in it, which is a lot. It's a lot. And wow. I've had a couple people come to me on that and show some dysregulated iron panel, you know, high serum iron, really high saturation percent that they shouldn't have had, and like not in a hemochromatosis type of situation. So anyway,
I don't know what the rationale would be to provide above and beyond. Already the US recommendations for iron in pregnancy are higher than a lot of countries at 27 milligrams. So what, I don't know what the rationale would be to go way above and beyond that. That's really interesting.
I think targeting it makes sense anemia? Yeah, it depends on, I mean, this is a whole nother rabbit hole, but it's definitely going to depend on whether ferritin levels are and whether, you know, usually if I don't give a prenatal that doesn't have a high amount of iron or no iron, then if their ferritin levels are low or they look, or they have any type of anemia, they're going to be going on supplemental iron. And then a lot of women, unfortunately, have to go on IV iron where they have to get transfused iron because there's either pathogens in the gut or, you know, something's wrong with the absorption process and they're not even absorbing it. So I have patients who are eating meat every day and then they have low ferritin and sometimes it's caused by heavy periods or just the fact that they aren't absorbing their iron at all. So I'm sure it's like genetic and gut health, all sorts of things. So,
I mean, ideally,
definitely a huge topic.
Yeah. Well, ideally, we would have the opportunity to look into what might be going on with iron status and be able to maybe address some of those underlying things that might be affecting that prior to conception. But certainly, yeah, if you're in an acutely anemic state and you're pregnant, you do what you got to do.
Well, and unfortunately, this stuff is, you know, treatable if you have the privilege of working with somebody in functional medicine who understands some of these caveats with typical iron panels and typical supplementation. We're not even talking about people who are supplementing with a very poorly absorbed form of iron, which almost every doctor who doesn't know anything about nutrition would be recommending, right? Not saying all doctors don't know about it, but there's a fair amount of doctors who would just give your ferrous sulfate or ferrous fumarate, and then you'd have somebody with horrible, horrible, painful constipation in pregnancy as a result. I mean, most people quit taking their iron supplements because of side effects, and that has to do with just recommending a bad form of iron, right? So yeah, we could do a whole podcast interview on this topic.
Yeah. Ideas for future episodes right here.
There you go.
So I had one last topic that I wanted to cover in this interview, and I'm probably opening up yet another can of worms with this question, but it really has to do with this very common, what most practitioners would refer to as a very evidence-based recommendation for fertility for both men and women to subscribe to more of a Mediterranean-style diet. So what are your thoughts on a Mediterranean style of eating? Is that even one single definable dietary pattern? And kind of how does that maybe compare to your recommendations and whatever else you can think of that would be interesting to bring up about this?
Yeah, can of worms for sure. So you set me up well in that there is not one single Mediterranean eating pattern. There's a lot of different countries with many different eating patterns along the Mediterranean Sea. So the way that I think it's interpreted in the research is that a Mediterranean diet is like a specific dietary pattern with low amounts of meat, especially low amounts of red meat and low amounts of saturated fat. It usually includes fish, eggs, legumes as more prominent protein sources. Sometimes includes dairy, and sometimes I see them recommend low fat. So it's sort of this like carryover from the US dietary guidelines. There is a focus on fruits and vegetables and olive oil. And that's what I see. I don't know if that's similar to what you see when you read a study on a Mediterranean diet.
Yeah, grains feature differently depending on what you're looking at. Mm-hmm. And that was one food group that you didn't mention in that. And it's like, okay.
That's right. They always have grains in there.
Yeah, mm-hmm. They're in there, but like, to what extent are they in there? And, you know, different studies feature them differently in the diet. So I think that this whole thing is interesting because we have sort of taken this entire part of the world and distilled it down into this one dietary pattern that we're now studying as like an intervention for fertility. And the research is very positive. And so that's something that we have to discuss, but there are some things that it limits, such as meat, which we've talked mm-hmm. about throughout this episode as being very nutrient dense. And, you know, we have to consider why we might be seeing some of these benefits with the reduction in extremely nutrient dense foods. And then, you know, maybe what we could do to amend this particular recommendation to be a little bit more nutrient dense.
Yeah. Well, I think the benefits of the Mediterranean diet in the way that it's interpreted in like Western medical literature is that you're limiting processed food and sugar, which we talked about from earlier. No matter what dietary pattern you're following, if you're limiting processed food and sugar, you're probably going to see some benefits. Mm-hmm. What I find frustrating about it is that, you know, if you watch like a cooking show from different countries along the Mediterranean, it doesn't look like the Mediterranean diet that's described in these papers. So they're cooking with, you know, oftentimes like a lot of fat. You see them pouring in like glug, glug, glug of the olive oil or pouring in the butter, cooking with fatty pork products. There's a lot of like traditionally fermented pork. So like sausages, prosciutto, hams. Moreover, they're
things
often,
we're told not to eat here.
Things
in the
you're
US,
told not to eat.
Cured meat.
Yeah, there's cured meat in there for sure. There's like aged Parmesan cheese, so introducing a fair amount of fat and salt. They seem to be pretty good about their flavor. You know, yeah, you have olives, but like, sure, olive oil, great. Olives are like super high in salt. Shouldn't that be, you know, off limits by conventional standards? Like, there's no limiting the salt around there. So I do find it interesting that our interpretation is that it's low meat and low fat, but in practice it doesn't appear to be so. In practice, it does appear to be a much more seasonal way of eating than we might eat in other parts of the world, and part of that is just the climate makes it easier to do that than if you're living really far north. But I do think we need to be cautious in interpreting a Mediterranean diet as always being low meat, because from what I see, it is not always. It's great that they include more fish, generally speaking. Again, that's a locally available food that they have access to. And you can see interventional trials, let's say on supplementing with omega-3 fats, that tend to show benefits on fertility health. Moreover, fish is going to provide a lot of different micronutrients other than DHA, which everybody focuses on the omega-3s, but if you're eating fish, you're also significantly contributing to your iodine, your selenium, your zinc, your iron, your B12, your B6, your vitamin D. I mean, there's a lot of things coming in from fish and seafood other than just DHA, which I think we can't, take that out of the discussion as well.
Yeah, I agree. I think my personal feelings around Mediterranean diet and the studies that are coming out is that, you know, we have to think about what they're comparing it to when we're showing specific effects for fertility. Of course, if we're comparing a whole food diet that limits sugar, processed carbohydrates, and then focuses on certain nutrient dense foods and quality fats that we know are really good for fertility, absolutely, we're going to see a benefit over a standard diet. And so I think that's one thing that's important to consider. Does that mean that we have compared a Mediterranean style of eating with every other possible dietary pattern out there and determined that it is the optimal one to make babies? I don't think we've done that. You know, have we compared it to a paleo style diet for fertility? I actually don't know whether or not that research has been done. I doubt it at this point. And I'm not necessarily advocating for a paleo style diet over a Mediterranean diet, but I think it's more, for me, it's more about looking at what exclusions we typically glean from these eating patterns and saying, well, if I'm eating Mediterranean, then I can't eat red meat. Or that means that red meat's bad for my fertility. Or that means that grains are really good for my fertility. And then that doesn't even take into account the bioindividuality concerns around like digestive function and whether or not these foods work for people. Mm-hmm. Women with PCOS who can't tolerate that much starch in the diet. Like,
right.
So I guess I just wanted to have like kind of a questioning and curious conversation about some of these studies that are coming out that tell us like you need to be on a Mediterranean diet if you're trying to conceive, and just kind of get your take.
Well,
on
I
that.
Mean, I agree with your take completely. Context always matters, right? I think the majority of these studies really are originally based on epidemiology. I think we're starting to see some more like clinical trial-based research come out of that, which that's the whole point of nutrition science, is to observe associations that we see in epidemiology. This population is eating XYZ, these are the health outcomes, and then to actually test them in clinical practice. I think we're seeing a little more of that, but I wish we would see a trial that's looking at people who specifically eating like, you know, high quality diet, but like eat red meat, don't eat red meat. Because how is the fertility rates?
That would be interesting.
Because
yeah.
What I see is when people are excluding red meat, just for the sake of excluding red meat, you're often seeing lower micronutrient intake. Now, some of the people who choose to eat less meat are the people who are also choosing to eat less processed foods. So if your idea of red meat is like a hamburger from McDonald's, and you're now going to be excluding your hamburger from McDonald's and eating something else that you cooked at home, yeah, we're going to see a benefit. But if your idea of red meat is, okay, I'm going to have, you know, a lentil, so I'm using a bad example because I'm a fan of lentils. I think they're a good healthy food, but like a lentil soup in place of having like steak tips and broccoli and something else for dinner, yeah, the lentil soup is great, but you're still getting a different nutritional profile. That meal now won't contain any vitamin B12 or heme iron. It won't contain any preformed vitamin A. It will contain some choline, but significantly less than what you would get in a meat, depending on the quantity of foods you consume. It'll have a different macronutrient profile, way more carbs on the lentil soup than you would be getting from your steak and veggies, right? There's always these considerations of, well, what replaced that and why is the person eating a particular way versus another way? And what else is going on in their lifestyle that factors into their choice to eat one way versus another? It's just,
and that's the problem.
Variables.
Yeah, with making these big blanket recommendations that can confuse people when they do have specific situations that might contraindicate some of the foods that are recommended in these guidelines. And I think that's the value of having somebody that is looking at things from a functional perspective that can really evaluate what your needs are and give you recommendations that they can be confident in based on their training and based on what they're seeing in you, as opposed to you having to be scared that you're bucking the trend because your body feels better when it eats more red meat. Like, And then we didn't even cover like digestive function in this and how that plays into what people are digesting and absorbing from their food. Any food that you consume that your body is not breaking down and absorbing nutrition from is not going to be great for you. You know, that's that's one thing to say about like why some people might feel better when they cut red meat out of their diet. Mm-hmm. They're not digesting that well, and you have protein fermentation in your gut. That's nasty, and it makes you feel nasty. And so when you cut red meat out, you might feel better. But my question is always, okay, why can't that very nutrient-dense food be included in the diet? What is going on there that might cause that person to exclude it? Same thing with legumes. I mean, I'm not like a super huge fan of grains, probably for the same reason that you're not. I don't think they need to be completely excluded, but they're not a food that I necessarily feel I need to help somebody strive to include in their diet, because less micronutrients, more starch, right? Like that's the deal. Some fiber, which is great, but not as much as veggies, which is not so great. But like legumes, for instance, have a better nutritional profile. And if somebody feels like crap every time they eat those, I'm still asking why on those foods. I'm not just like, oh yeah, that's fine. You can eat paleo, but we really need to figure out why you can't eat red meat. Like that's not me at all. It's how do we figure out how to get your body to digest, absorb, and feel good on the most nutrient-dense, variety-filled diet possible?
Amen to that. I mean, I completely agree. Amen. These are a lot of questions that I think people don't even consider, like the digestive one. Like, you know, maybe the person has been on proton pump inhibitors or some kind of acid blocking interfering medication for years and years, or their liver and gallbladder health is not well. Yeah, they're probably going to feel like crap eating meat and eating just enough fat, not even a high fat diet, because that's an underlying problem that hasn't been addressed.
Yeah. Liver, gallbladder function. I mean, there's so many things to consider, but I just wanted to make sure that we like opened up this topic in a more thoughtful way instead of, you know, bringing dogma into it. Like, let's break it down and talk about what the considerations are and what people need to think about when it comes to diet. So this was a fantastic interview. I so enjoyed having you back. I love this. I feel like this would, you would be so fun to just like go have a cup of tea with and nerd out about nutrition for like an entire day.
That's basically what I do every day. So.
Yeah. Fair enough. Well, thank you again, Lily, for joining us. And we will have links to Real Food for Pregnancy and a couple of the blog posts that we talked about that had some information about the topics that we discussed today. I hope everybody enjoyed this interview. Go follow Lily on Instagram. She's got tons of great information coming out and always tells you when her new blog posts are available. And we look forward to seeing you again here on the podcast in the future.
Hey, likewise. I'd love to come back on.